the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sunny to me, and that was the outstanding Francis Sinatra introducing me the night that he hosted The Tonight Show, and I luckily was the first person he invited to be on as a guest, and you can Google the stand-up on YouTube. Welcome to John Barber's world, probably the only world that isn't falling apart. As you know, since Friday, the media has been swamped with pundits and preachers talking about the killings in Dallas. Now it's my turn, and I warn you, you might not like what I have to say, especially if, as Jack Nicholson said in A Few Good Men, you can't handle the truth. The one good thing that came out of Dallas is that it shut up Hillary and Donald for a while, the Bonnie and Clyde of this fake election. This carnage revisited Dallas, the city chosen in 1963 by our warmongering government to publicly murder our president so they could lie us into Vietnam and murder millions of other innocents. From Christopher Columbus, who murdered thousands of natives who found him lost in the ocean looking for China, Columbus then cut off some of the survivors' hands to teach them the value of private property. From him to the Europeans landing at Plymouth Rock, American farms from New England to California were watered with the blood of 9 million murdered Native Americans. After building the country on black and yellow slave labor, we began building an empire on more million innocent murders in Mexico, in the Philippines. As Marine General Smedley Butler said, quote, "I was just a hired killer for the bankers and the corporations," unquote. In my lifetime, I've been witness to our proven government murders of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and probably Malcolm X. I've seen innocent Indian Americans murdered at Wounded Knee, innocent white Americans murdered at Ruby Ridge, innocent Black Panthers murdered in Chicago, all by the FBI. And worst of all, the husband of the woman who would be president, Bill Clinton, murdered dozens of, again, innocent women and children at Waco. Up until a few decades ago, soldiers could take pride in killing for their country and empire. They could do it and get medals in hand-to-hand combat. Today, that patriotic pleasure is denied them. They kill millions now of unseen strangers from Iraq to Afghanistan in fake wars by remote control. Fake wars for which the guilty like Bush and Cheney and Powell and Rice go unpunished. Also unpunished, cops who kill innocent drivers or pedestrians. This year, 509 already. They don't look so much like killings as executions. We are a country built and maintained by violence. We churn out movies and media and video games that celebrate violence. A country like ours that lives by the sword might be dying by its own sword. Over the weekend, there was much talk of martial law, which may return us to hand-to-hand combat and a constitution. And now, the media wants to tell us sob stories and sing sad songs about the violence last Friday because one outraged black veteran had had enough. Well, to quote my good friend Jim Nabors and his character Gomer Pyle, does it come as any surprise, surprise, surprise? No, it doesn't. A lot of folks think the problem with the world is the Rothschild family. Others may think it's the Clintons and the Bushes, America's Sopranos and Corleone families. Well, folks, you may be surprised that it is probably neither. I have just had the privilege of seeing a 2.5-hour work-in-progress documentary by our guest. Now, I think I'm quite knowledgeable about politics, and I learned watching this that I don't know much at all, especially about neocons. It has truly important and frightening information, and if the nuggets of gold in this film come out as I expect, it may well be one of the most important political documentaries ever made in America. It brings to light a neocon family I had never heard of, who may be worse than all the others, America's political Manson family. It is a learning pleasure to welcome the filmmaker and very accomplished musician who is also co-host with his very bright sister, Abby Martin, of a wonderful show called Media Roots, ladies and gentlemen, Robbie Martin. Robbie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, John.
Listen, it's more of a pleasure to have you. And before we get into the substance of that work in progress that I saw, which is going to be unbelievable, could you tell us just a little bit about your background, where you were born, what you were interested in doing as a kid? Do you have any other siblings besides Abby?
No, Abby's the only one. Separated by 3 years. She's my younger sister. And she actually got into politics before I did. So she kind of got into it through her college activism. And she was there many years before me diving into this stuff. I was more, I would say, more of a kind of a hobbyist. I would look at a lot of this stuff on the internet, watch a lot of conspiracy videos, watch quite a bit of sort of, 9/11 truth videos, a lot of stuff on JFK. So my knowledge was sort of there mostly. And then there was an incident that happened to me around 2004 where a friend of mine had this harebrained idea to create a fake beheading video, parody, I suppose you could call it, of an Al-Qaeda beheading video.
Oh my God.
So we filmed this video in our garage, and it didn't look real to me at all. It was very phony looking. We put it on a file sharing network. We never sent it to any media organizations of any kind. But
was a guy in an orange suit when you did it?
No. No, we didn't even care about those kind of details. We didn't think that anything would come out of it. We thought it would just be sort of a weird internet hoax, that only a few people would see. But what happened was, after we put it on some file sharing networks, it actually got to Reuters and AP, and they ran with the story as if it was a real beheading.
Oh, my God.
And by the time that they discovered it was a hoax, it was already too late, because a lot of international news outlets had already picked up the wire story and ran with it. So it took about 24 to 48 hours for the story to fully be reversed and broadcast as a hoax. So that was kind of, for me, I wasn't really even that political when I did it. I mean, I was definitely anti the Iraq war. I didn't really buy into the war on terror. I was dating a Japanese citizen at the time 9/11 happened, and she kind of like helped open my eyes to the fact that America had all this horrible foreign policy legacy. I mean, a lot of this stuff I was ignorant to originally, but this event, making this beheading video and the media response to it, just completely opened my eyes to one, how false the media is and how hysterical the media was over the war on terror. And then two, I guess, just how there are groups of people out there who take advantage of these situations and try to utilize them for their own purposes. So, in this instance, it was like a means to dehumanize Muslims even more than we already had, because this happened right after the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. So I saw a lot of people in the media trying to seize on it as, oh, well, these people cut people's heads off. They're so barbaric that, you know, this torture thing at Abu Ghraib, that was minor compared to the fact that these Muslims are, you know, animals, is basically what they're trying to say in the media. It's kind of the climate that they're putting out. So that was, for me, a crash course in politics and media kind of all at once. And from there, that just started sort of my journey into, you know, dabbling into writing, doing the podcast with my sister, and then eventually working with her a little bit on Breaking the Set. You know, there's a few episodes that we sort of collaborated on, and then deciding to do this documentary. So I guess, well,
I must say, two things that, as I said at the top of the show, that I think that I'm fairly political aware. I mean, I watched everything when they started Shock and Awe, because I knew that those buildings did not come down with the airplane. As a matter of fact, I heard Hunter Thompson, the Gonzo journalist, the day after it happened, he was on Australian radio, and he said, this is an inside job. I mean, yeah. That quickly he said it. Okay, and then I was watching Phil Donahue one day, and he wanted to have somebody on to question the rush to the Iraq war, and the head of NBC News fired him. And it was one of the few times I ever wrote a scathing letter, because when they fired Phil Donahue for questioning the Vietnam War, the Iraq war, the president said he is not waving the flag enough. Well, it's not the job of a journalist to wave the flag. It's his job to wave the Constitution. But the thing that I was surprised at, and I really thought I knew a lot, were the two things that you revealed in your work in progress. And the first thing was about, I do not remember seeing as much anti-Muslim dialogue as you have captured in this documentary you're working on. Tell me why you think that happened. And then I want you to introduce the Manson family, America's political Manson family, whom I had never heard about.
Yeah, well, to me, it's one of those things where the day of 9/11 itself was such an emotional roller coaster for everybody, that little breadcrumbs and different things that happened on that day, I think really important things kind of got brushed under the rug or even just, you know, totally forgotten about. And one of those things was that almost to the very minute that the Pentagon was hit, and, you know, we saw that smoke cloud billowing from the top of the Pentagon, and the news cameras, the choppers filming it, they started to announce that a Palestinian group called the DFLP had claimed responsibility for the attacks. Now, 9:40 in the morning that's when a lot of people are waking up on the West Coast. So when I remember waking up on the morning of 9/11, calling my mom, talking to her, you know, what's happening? Because she had already been up. She had seen some of the news before I was actually awake. And sort of from what we could infer, it was that some Palestinian group had done 9/11. So I remembered that from the day. But, you know, as the years went on, I forgot about it. And then when I found this, you know, you described them as the Manson family, which I don't think is as unfair. I mean, I would agree with that. You know, two members of this family, Don and Fred Kagan, going onto the radio on 9/12 the day after, saying that we should attack Palestine, or essentially send U.S. ground troops into Palestine as a response to 9/11. It wasn't until I saw that clip where I kind of thought to myself, well, that's really interesting, because I remembered on the day of 9/11 that they were sort of almost trying to blame Palestinians for a good 2 hours on television. So,
you know, I don't recall that, but boy, you certainly pointed out in the film that you're working on. It is frightening. I mean, they were not Iraqi passports. There weren't Palestinian passports. They don't have a state anyway yet. They were Arab passports.
Yeah, it's it's really scary to think that, you know, we look back on the Bush administration and George Bush and Cheney as, you know, willing to go as far as they possibly could with the war on terror. But this is actually an instance where, for some reason or another, these neocons outside their administration were actually trying to get us to go even farther with our warfare. And Bush decided, you know, Bush did not go along with that part of the script. So that was really fascinating to me. But it was actually an accidental find, as I was already really fascinated by the words and sort of the rhetoric of Robert Kagan, who, similar to your experience, I didn't even know about him. I had already known about PNAC. I already knew about Bill Kristol. I knew about a lot of the signatories of these Project for the New American Century letters, but Robert Kagan never really got onto my radar. I had heard his name before, but when I actually started to watch him speak on C-SPAN and just and read his writings, I was very disturbed by how effective his rhetoric was in what seemed like him rebranding neoconservatism for a new era. You know, not really that new of an era. It's just 8 years after Bush. So it was kind of like for the Obama era, he was pushing out a lot of materials trying to appeal to liberal interventionists, trying to create a bridge between the two, kind of, you know, almost trying to put out an olive branch saying, look, you know, we know that Bush took all this rhetoric too far, but really there is something here that's really important, and we want to put this out in a more reasonable sounding way now. And that's what they've done, and that's kind of why I made this movie.
It wasn't one of the Godfather Kagans once a communist or a socialist?
That would be Irving Kristol, the father of Bill Kristol.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I recall that now. Now, what you've brought up, which is so interesting, is how this anti-Muslim rhetoric was picked up by Donald Trump, and now the Kagans have a different approach. You would think that they might be supporting Trump, but I get the impression and the information from your documentary that while they once took over the foreign policy for George Bush and got us into Iraq on behalf of Israel, now they may be moving to not support Trump, but to support Hillary. And then one of the sound bites from one of these folks, one of these Kagans, was he's really applauding the state of perpetual war for the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very strange thing to watch what seemed like a core element of the GOP for so long actually ready to lose the election. You know, their party will lose the election so that they could apply what they see as this important foreign policy ideology to whatever president will get in, regardless of what party they are. And that happens to be Hillary Clinton. And that clip you're referring to of Don Kagan, it was really interesting to me because his whole framework is that he has studied war throughout all of history, ancient history, modern history. And his philosophy is he believes that war is a natural state of human society and that it is perpetual and that there's really no reason to think that that's going to change. So therefore, you know, we should it's almost like a framework to box in the worldview to such an extent where there really is no point of view that to seeing that as bad. It's just it is how it is. And to me, that's a whole new take on sort of the state of perpetual war, and other neocons don't really have that exact worldview. And you'll sort of see a little bit of, you know, differences between their worldviews. There are some nuances and differences, but ultimately it all is there to create an intellectual underpinning for American exceptionalism.
How many are in this family? And I think there are a few women who also hold very prominent positions in shaping foreign policy for this country.
Absolutely, yeah. The main one is Victoria Nuland, and she kind of became known to people. Most of them probably people who watched Russia Today, because this wasn't really broadcast in the American news very much. When she said F the EU on a leaked phone call to Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine. And this leaked phone call came out during the Sochi Olympics. It was when the Ukrainian government seemed to be losing its position, and there was an uprising that seemed to be threatening the stability of the country. And in that phone call, a part that the American media barely talked about is something much more important, where she actually goes through and kind of throws out all these names with Jeffrey Pyatt about which person from the opposition they want to take over the Ukrainian government. They're playing musical chairs with essentially a coup d'etat that's in progress.
Oh, goodness.
And when this phone call came out, she was extremely embarrassed, obviously sort of publicly shamed, but that was really the only moment where she had any exposure to the mainstream press. This whole time, she's been essentially in charge of the U.S. foreign policy in the Eastern Bloc. So she's the Assistant Secretary of State for Eurasian Affairs, and she got this position kind of at the perfect time when her husband was ramping up a new hostile, aggressive sort of posture towards Russia, trying to sort of restart a Cold War mentality. And it all kind of perfectly lined up. And then you have his sister-in-law, Kim Kagan, who runs one of the most, I would say, one of the most prominent think tanks, war think tanks in Washington, D.C., called the Institute for the Study of War.
Oh.
You'll see their maps being used. Anytime you look at a map in the newspaper about Syrian rebel activity or Russian troop movements, I'd say 50% of the time you look at down at the corner for the reference, and it'll say from the Institute for the Study of War. That's just how – this is an example of how prominent this particular think tank is.
Robbie, America seems to be taking up Trump's battle cry, a lot of horrible anti-Muslim rhetoric now, a lot of horrible anti-Muslim cartoons. I mean, they're just – it's a tsunami in the internet, okay? Why is it that the Kagans, who ramped this up after 9/11, all this anti-Muslim rhetoric, why is it that they are not supporting Donald Trump, in your mind?
Well, it took me a long time to figure out the answer to that, because it is very strange that Don and Fred put out such inflammatory rhetoric against Muslims, at such a crucial time, an emotional time for everybody, and they're distancing themselves from Trump. I mean, Robert Kagan's even gone as far as calling Trump a fascist, that he's going to bring fascism to this country, which arguably what is more accurate label to describe some of these neocons who are in the Bush administration and their point of view on the world, because Trump is not... there's a component of fascism that I think is a requirement, where it has to also have sort of a messianic world domination component to it. Trump doesn't have that. He may be a narcissist and an egomaniac, but his anti-Muslim rhetoric is more coming from a place of national identity, protectivism, isolationism. And I think that when these neocons like the Kagans put out anti-Islamic rhetoric, they never wanted it to get to a level where we would want to ban Muslims from immigrating into the country. I think that their purpose of putting out anti-Muslim and anti-Arabic rhetoric was because they knew that when you're fighting a war, you have to present America as good and the enemy as evil. So because America is essentially fairly ignorant on Islam and the Muslim world, they had to dehumanize these people to be able to wage the wars more easily. And I think that was their purpose of putting out Islamophobic rhetoric. And when they saw Trump and sort of this more Pat Buchanan era conservatism mixing, stealing some of the wind from their sails about ISIS and how we need to go destroy ISIS, I think that's when they started to get worried that Trump was actually taking their rhetoric which is their, you know, their greatest tools are sort of these rhetorical arguments they're able to make. Trump is using those and turning it against them and making it so that, you know, his idea of waging a war on ISIS is just go in there, bomb the crap out of them, get out and worry about our country here, make our country great again. The neocons want to make the rest of the world in our image. So that's a whole different, you know, thing. It might seem the same on the surface, but I think the neocons see this as a threat to almost their worldview, that he's tapping into the almost like a more visceral emotion.
Robbie, Joe Satilli, who's going to join us in just a few minutes after the break, my permanent sidekick on this show, and I think one of the best journalists in the country and with one of the best newsletters, News Vandal, months and months ago, not mentioning Muslims or anything like that, months and months ago, he predicted on the show, or he said on the show, John, you watch and wait, a lot of the very conservative Republicans will be voting for Hillary Clinton and not for Donald Trump. And I was surprised when he said that, but it no longer surprises me now. Some of the Kagans, are they moving into Hillary's camp? Is Hillary embracing any one of these people?
That's a really interesting question. And, you know, at first I thought that, you know, if Robert Kagan was going to be advising her campaign, it would sort of be done on a shadow level, you know, in secret. Because he, I don't know if you watched this part of the documentary yet, but he actually got his first appointment in the U.S. State Department since he was a young man under Reagan from Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State under Obama. She created this a foreign affairs policy board that was comprised of several old school cold warriors, one of them being Strobe Talbot, who was sort of largely responsible for this Clinton era NATO expansion. Robert Kagan was another appointment to this foreign affairs policy board. So the combination of these two guys on that board, you really have to wonder what, you know, it almost begs the question, was Hillary Clinton, you know, is she, how much more hawkish is she than Obama? And I think if you look at all these different events and throughout Obama's presidency and what Hillary Clinton was trying to do and different things that she wanted to do differently than Obama, it's clear that she actually is far more hawkish than even Obama, who I personally have a lot of problems with his foreign policy. I mean, to me, it is very Bush-like. But, you know, Hillary Clinton actually wanted to go harder on Syria, and she wanted to go harder on Libya and a lot of these other things that Obama kind of went, in their mind, more soft on.
One of the things that I'm surprised that Bernie Sanders never did, because I recall in one of the debates when Bernie was saying that, you know, we should have some kind of negotiations. We shouldn't be at war in the Middle East. We should be able to talk to the Palestinians. And she said, no, she would continue the wars. I mean, she actually said it, and she got applause, which absolutely stunned me. But what shocked me, and it was one of the most reprehensible things I've ever seen one of our politicians do after they murdered Gaddafi in Libya. They had this short clip of her saying, we came, we saw, we killed. And then she cackled like the Wicked Witch of the North in the Wizard of Oz. I mean, I just loathed that woman when I saw her. And I was shocked that Bernie Sanders would not play that and say to the audience, do you want this kind of person to be president of the United States? When we come back, we're going to be joined by Joe, but I want to know, why is it that the Kagans, who have so much influence over our foreign policy, first with the Republicans, and now it looks like probably with Hillary, if Hillary is successful, why they fly so low under the media's radar? We'll be right back after this.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show. or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber, he put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you so much. I'd like to welcome you all back, especially Robbie Martin, and we're going to meet Joe in just a second. I want to thank George Neff for that wonderful unsolicited review, which he did on Coast to Coast. If you go to Amazon and you get The Last Word on the Assassination, which is all you'll ever need to have if you want to be informed about the truth of the assassination, all of the funds from that, and surprisingly, without anything but word of mouth, it sells anywhere from 30 to 50 units a month. All that money is going into part two, which will be out this November 22nd. It's called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And one of the major contributors to that documentary is my regular here, one of the best journalists in the country and the originator of News Vandal. Joe, welcome back to the show. And thanks for coming. Thanks for finding Robbie and joining us.
Well, I mean, you know, finding Robbie, that was easy because Robbie's easy to be found, particularly with this amazing piece of work that he's done. I call it the third part of a triptych because you have two other parts of this, right, Robbie?
Yes.
And what, they're all under the same title?
Yeah, each one has a subtitle. So the first one is A Catalyzing Event because that one is kind of right after 9/11 and sort of coming right off of that. The second one is How We Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the New Neocons, about the, you know, the new standoff with Russia and the new generation of neocons. And the third one is Maintaining the World Order, and it's sort of a titular, you know, based on a phrase that the Kagans really particularly like saying and repeating.
I want to follow up on that because I want to ask you very quickly, and I know John wants to follow up on why the media hasn't covered the Kagans, but these may actually interlock, because what we hear a lot about now is Russia, 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 like the way Donald Trump used to talk about China. And I wonder the extent to which the neocons' primary obsession has always been Russia, and in some ways the obsession with global international terrorism, or the war on terror, the global war on terror, is kind of like methadone until they could get their next Russia heroin fix. It's almost like the methadone between the Cold War and the emerging Cold War 2.0. To what extent do you think that Russia is actually central to their ideology?
Well, at first, when I first started making this, I thought about it kind of more along the lines of the framework you just laid out, that it sort of the war on terror was a temporary narrative just so they could get to this point where they could reignite a Cold War posture towards Russia. But after making this, I've had a little bit of a change in my viewpoint, just in the sense that, you know, when people ask me, what is the goal of this? You know, is it just to, you know, landlock Russia, or is it just like a, you know, a global chess game? I've come to this belief now where I almost feel like it's all about opportunity for them. That's the most important thing. If they could find an opportunity to symbolically push forward this sort of image of American dominance, they will do that. And I think ultimately that is the most important goal. And because this opportunity has come up with Russia and Putin, the Cold War was a very convenient way for them to push forward sort of that symbolism. And they're just going, you know, and because it was so easy and natural for them, and because they learned how to do it so well, they're just merely going back to that now. So I think that, you know, it's hard to say if the war on terror was just a temporary stepping stone to get to that. So I'm not sure, ultimately.
Robbie, would you mind if I made this observation? And the observation is this, about the Kagans. You could look at the Rothschilds and say, well, the Rothschilds are doing this for money, because the Rothschilds centuries ago said they didn't care who was in government, who made the laws, it was just who cashed the checks. And you could say the Clintons are in it for the money with this foundation that they have, or the Bushes are in it for the money. That's why they're killers, okay? That's why they're imperialists. You never get that impression from the Kagans. And while they support the military-industrial complex, you never once get the impression that it's for money as much as it is for power.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation, because it's something that I've asked many times while making this, because, one, they're not famous. They're not fame-seeking people.
No.
They don't work in sort of the political sector in the same way, you know, the Clintons and other families do. They're not billionaires. So I think, you know, I actually do think on some level they are true believers. And it's almost like this is their, you know, this is almost like the American religion to them. I don't know, you know, I think they're probably secular Jews. I don't even think that they are, you know, practicing religion. They don't practice any religion. They're probably atheists. So I see this almost like they believe so strongly in this American exceptionalism. And
don't you think true believers are much more dangerous than true bankers?
Possibly so, yeah. I think on a certain level, yeah, for sure.
Why do you think then, and Joe, why do you think they have flown so under the radar? I mean, when somebody is informed as I am and learning about them by watching Robbie's movie, it scares me.
Well, outside of Newland, nobody has really been in a position where they have to go before Congress and justify policy positions or decisions that are made. There's a lack of accountability in the world of think tanks. And really, think tanks, and I had the occasion of working in a think tank. It was the no longer extant Center for Defense Information, which was created by Admiral Eugene LaRoc as a response to the excesses of the Pentagon in Vietnam. And so it was a Pentagon watchdog. And I was there it's kind of like the corollary of Embassy Row, Think Tank Row, right there next to the Brookings Building and whatnot off of Mass Avenue. And it's a world unto itself. It is funded by corporate interests. Many of these think tanks are funded by the military-industrial complex. And the people who work in them often go in between government and think tanks like a revolving door, and they can slide in and make policy recommendations and affect policy and move out of that position before it actually has its impact. Then they can write about the policies that they created when they were consulting with government. They live in a nebulous sort of gray zone between accountability and power. And I think this is one of the things that the Kagans have done quite artfully, is occupy that space. And it's a space that keeps them out of the public eye, but gives them ever more influence as America. It's in a sense, it's almost as if the less they are in the public eye, the more power they're able to wield. Would you say that's true, Robbie?
Yeah. No, I definitely think so.
Yeah.
Robbie, as somebody who was a multi-Emmy winner as a critic, I would offer this suggestion to you with this film. You have wonderful material all throughout the entire film, all of it extremely important. There is nothing more important than the information that you've gathered about this Kagan family. And I think if you somehow did just a documentary focused on this political Manson family, it could be an hour, it could be an hour and 20 minutes, I don't know how long it would be, you would have the most important, most informative political documentary truly ever made in this country. Now, if that were done, what kind of reaction do you think you would get if all of a sudden this film went viral about the Kagans, who up till now have been as secret as the members of Skull and Bones?
It's funny you should mention Skull and Bones, actually, because after I finished making this movie, I found out that Robert Kagan was a member of Skull and Bones, and
of course
he actually was a bonesman in his late 20s, which is a weird divergence from the normal bonesman age, and he went to Yale in his late 20s, not even as a graduate student. So, but I think that the reaction would be, if it went viral, I would probably experience the wrath of some of these neocons, because they are incredibly good at smearing people in the media, you know, manipulating the narrative, negatively spinning things. I mean, part of the reason I made this documentary is because I think in a large way, some of these neocons actually tried to take down my sister Abby when she was working for RT back in around 2014.
I must tell you about your sister Abby, by the way. She had the best, the most informative show on the entire planet. I include a major media in this country, major media in Europe. I know it was on the internet. It was on Russia Today. You must tell her that I think that she had the very best show ever on the internet.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I'll pass that on.
Well, sure. Robbie, I want to follow up with that. So what was the nature of the attack? And have you experienced anything yet as a result of producing this triptych? I'm sure that this final piece hasn't made its way to the Kagans yet. You wonder if they actually try to avoid watching some of these things, or they have underlings who watch these things and, you know, write up a analysis so that they can come up with talking points. But what's the nature of the attack usually by neocons when they are pointed to? And because in many ways, neocon has become an epithet, and even in popular American political discourse.
Yeah, I think, well, one of the main ways is if you criticize Israel, they'll find a way to twist your words and your statements into, you know, portraying you as anti-Semitic. And neocons have even gone as far, and I show a lot of this in my movie, actually. There was an old sort of pushback talking point that the neocons would use, where people who are criticizing neocons would fire back and say, well, all these people you're going after are Jewish. So is this, you know, that almost seems like a racist code you're using, where when you're calling us neocons, what you really mean is Jew. So that's actually a very common tactic that they used to use. And I think some of these more liberal critics of neocons boxed themselves in by leaning a little too hard on this idea that all neocons were Israel firsters and had dual loyalties, when I think it's a lot more complex than that. And I think ultimately it is about American hegemony. So, but so far, it's been pretty much ignored. These movies have been ignored by neocons out there. Jamie Kirchick, actually one of the sort of the underlings, the new neocons I show in my movie, mentioned it in a Daily Beast article, kind of, you know, trashing it before it even came out. And I guess he got the impression that I was making a documentary all about him. And that's what he wrote in this Daily Beast article.
But haven't you found, though, Robbie, that some of the most articulate and some of the brightest critics of Israel and its policies are Jews themselves?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a very cheap, below the belt smear tactic, and I think that they could still, you know, they'll still pull it out. They'll still pull out that talking point if they see an opportunity for it. I mean, basically what they did to my sister is they claimed that her statements on RT, sort of taking an independent stance, saying that she didn't agree with what Russia or the United States was doing in Crimea, they took that and twisted it around and made it seem like Russia staged the whole thing, that her editorial speech on her show was a Russian false flag. So that was actually their method of attack. And it's actually quite strange when you think about how many of these neocons also use the method of attack of calling you a conspiracy theorist.
Right.
You know, they despise truthers. You know, some of them have called, you know, tried to, you know, smear my work by just saying I'm a truther or whatever. So, and so they're some of the biggest conspiracy theorists of them all, actually.
Isn't that horrible that the word truther becomes sort of a profane word? You would think it would be a compliment. When you and Abby then started doing Media Roots, was she forced out of Russia today, or did she leave Russia today? And why did you, and by the way, that's a terrific title for a show called Media Roots. How and why did you start Media Roots, and where can we hear it? Where can people hear it?
Well, Abby actually started Media Roots before she started doing Breaking the Set. We talk kind of in depth about why she decided to leave RT, combination of a lot of circumstances. She stayed on for about a year after she made that statement. The podcast, has been going for, I don't know, maybe about 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And, you can actually check it out at mediaroots.org. Or if you just want to go directly to soundcloud.com/media-roots, you can check them all.
How often is it on?
We try to do it once every 2 weeks, but sometimes we slip and forget. So, but I'd say it's once every 2 weeks at best.
Do you have an archive so that if somebody went there and you weren't on live, do you have an archive?
Oh, yeah. We have, there's about 100 episodes up there right now.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, now where do you see this election going, and where do you see the neocons going?
It seems like it's already kind of, they've already decided where they're going to go. The neocons, some of the more influential ones, the more important ones, have decided to get behind Hillary. And Trump is still, to me, is still a wild card situation, because we don't even know for sure who his VP pick is going to be. And there's a lot of signs that there are actually neocons in his administration advising him, like John Bolton. And one of his potential VP picks was going to be Newt Gingrich, who has gone quite far to the neocon side at different parts of his career. It's really hard to predict. I mean, I think what's going to happen is you're going to start seeing Hillary Clinton having this very honed, focused, informed sounding foreign policy rhetoric that's largely going to be coming from sort of these more neoliberal style neocons like Robert Kagan and Eric Edelman. There's actually a fundraiser coming up on the 21st of July in D.C. hosted by Robert Kagan for Hillary Clinton. And When I first saw it, this guy named John Hudson, I believe, writing for Foreign Policy Magazine, was the first one to break the story that this fundraiser was happening. And you know, at first everybody thought, oh, it's kind of been done behind the scenes. They're not really advertising it. But no, it's actually on Hillary Clinton's website. It's got Robert Kagan's name on it. It's in the event calendar. So this is a full out of the shadows. There's no hide. You know, they're not trying to hide the fact that they're allying with Hillary Clinton. It's very much a public push they're making for her.
Excuse me, Joe, just this observation and then continue. The real tragedy in the triumvirate who were running for the White House, Bernie Sanders, Hillary, and Donald Trump, is that only two of them had only a foreign policy and only one had a domestic policy, and that was Bernie Sanders. I mean, it is unbelievable to me that in this day and age where there are no real enemies, quite honestly, that an American presidential candidate does not have a strong domestic policy.
Yeah.
True that. I want to ask you one more thing about the Kagans and Hillary. And Hillary's domestic policy, such as it is really focused on the projection of strength internationally. And you could see over the weekend when the Bernie Sanders folks, I watched some of the proceedings on C-SPAN, tried to get a stark anti-Trans-Pacific Partnership plank in the platform and essentially failed. There's a strong admonition that trade deals have to be fair, but they failed in getting the kind of plank that they wanted to get, because ultimately the capital flows that are insured by U.S. military projection, that is something that Hillary Clinton sees as essentially her domestic policy, which is that the more we have capital flows, the more likely it is we'll have globalization. And we all know that that does great things for the American economy. But one thing about the neocons I wanted to ask you, you mentioned opportunism more than once. And I'm always trying to figure out what the core is of their ideology. What is that core belief? I've spent a lot of time reading about Leo Strauss and the Neoplatonic ideal and the big lie and these things. To what extent are they motivated really by American exceptionalism, or to what extent is American exceptionalism a tool? And let me just make a quick corollary there. I believe that one of the reasons why Robert Kagan is so strongly supporting Hillary Clinton is because that's a fast track to get Victoria Nuland into the position of Secretary of State, or at least something nearly as juicy as Secretary of State, which would give him and his family and his like-minded friends an opportunity to really affect policy on a global scale. To what extent do you think American exceptionalism is like that, just an opportunistic tool that they're using for whatever their programmatic aims are?
It's hard to answer that one because I think they're obviously incredibly arrogant people. So, you know, at a certain point, you do wonder. It's one of those chicken or egg things. It really is, because, you know, obviously on some level, you know, Kim Kagan is raking in money from defense contractor donations. I mean, her salary, quote unquote, is entirely from defense contractors' money being contributed to the Institute for the Study of War, and so.
Their bread is getting buttered. I mean,
absolutely.
It's not like they're not going begging here. So they're not getting rich. It's not like Clinton Foundation rich, right? It's not like you know, Bush Family Holdings. It's not like Arbusto Oil, you know, getting money from the Saudis to make it grow. But money is not necessarily the motivating factor, which is to John's point earlier. You know, when you can follow the money, at least you could say, well, he's a sociopath. Like, if you think that, let's just say you may consider Trump a sociopath, but it's a sociopathy that makes sense. Fame and money, that's something that we can all kind of understand. But the nebulous desire to reshape mankind according to some sort of ideological program is something that's darker and deeper and harder to mine. And I think it's one of the – perhaps is that one of the reasons why they've spent so much time in the shadows?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. And on some level, when you were just talking about Trump's, you know, if he is a sociopath, it makes more sense. it just kind of made me think that, you know, any real leader or like political leader could use sort of this neocon worldview and the methods and the strategies to sort of create their own reality.
Right.
It's very effective rhetoric and ways of making arguments. But you know, and then when you're talking about Leo Strauss earlier, you know, the way he sort of introduces a lot of these, you know, introduced a lot of this ideology, because arguably a lot of it came from him, is through the teachings of Machiavelli.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and then when you start reading a lot of that stuff and his interpretations of Machiavelli, and then like Michael Ledeen's interpretations of Machiavelli,
oh boy. Yeah.
And even Robert Kagan's interpretations of Machiavelli, you know, that thread connects through even, you know, some of the more extreme neocons like Michael Ledeen, but all the way to Robert Kagan. And you really understand that they are both echoing some of the, you know, really those core philosophies of Machiavelli on how to rule and run a state and a society. And Machiavelli, you know, in his writings, I mean, he echoes similar sentiments to Irving Kristol, that religion is ultimately just a tool to sort of rule, you know, and to use. It's less about what the ideology means and more about control, I guess.
Well, and that would get you to John DeLulio's famous letter when he left the White House as being in charge of outreach to religious groups. He called the people who were running the White House Mayberry Machiavellis.
Joe, that's wonderful. And it's a great line to close on. Joe, now that you're up on Patreon with your news vandal, tell people how they can subscribe to you, how they can find you, where you'll be heard next, and where they can get your news vandal.
Well, news vandal, you just go to newsvandal.com. The box will pop up. You can sign up and get the newsletter. If you want to support the newsletter, it's Patreon, patreon.org, Patreon, and you just search for News Vandal. I'm there. You can chime in a buck or two. And tomorrow night I'll be on, as always, on the Ocelli Effect from 6 to 7 on American Freedom Radio, and we'll be talking about history. This, I'll probably be talking more about this because Robbie's really got me going here.
Well, that's Joe, thank you again. I want to thank Mike Kim, my producer, and Doug Newsom, our engineer. And most of all, Robbie, I want to thank you. Tell us once again where every 2 weeks they can find Media Roots if you two show up.
Well, mediaroots.org. It's always at the top right corner of the page. There'll be a SoundCloud embed. You'll see it up there. And you, if you want to watch A Very Heavy Agenda, it's out right now on, you can watch it streaming or download it or get a DVD at averyheavyagenda.com. And thank you again, John and Joe. This is a great pleasure talking
to you. Well, you're going to have to do this again, Robbie. Believe me, you were just wonderful. I want to thank you all. And as Ed Murrow used to say, good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. Desire, a sunny, 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 I love you.